On the program today, Defense Contracting 101, why you might want to think about Huawei just a little bit more seriously, and we will take you out to the ball game. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday today, the 10th of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. One files the corporate news of the day. The all-stock transaction, a merger of equals, it's being called, joining the giant defense contractor Raytheon with the giant aerospace company United Technologies, forming the more giant, if not especially imaginatively named, Raytheon Technologies. One files that transaction under the heading, duh, have you seen the defense and aerospace businesses lately? If the deal does make it past regulators, the $100 billion result would be the number two company in that space behind Boeing. So, Marketplace's Kimberly Adams gets us going with some market-based realities from Washington.
Raytheon and United Technologies say the merger's important for them to keep their balance in shifting markets. Doug Gates is head of aerospace and defense for KPMG.
They're looking at it in this acquisition truly as a long-term view that this combined company will be able to ride the ups and downs of the market.
Raytheon has a big defense contracting business. United Technologies is big in commercial aviation.
If commercial is slowing down, they've got large military might, and vice versa.
Another reason behind the merger? The idea that bigger is better. Riz McCormick is a fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
The merger would create a company that would rival Boeing and Lockheed as the largest defense contractor, continuing a trend of consolidation that's been ongoing since the 1990s.
That consolidation worries President Trump. He expressed concern this morning that too much consolidation in the defense industry may raise prices for the U.S. military and, by extension, taxpayers. But Jerry McGinn, executive director of the Center for Government Contracting, says this merger is unlikely to face a lot of pushback from federal regulators.
Because there's not a tremendous amount of overlap between these two companies in terms of the markets they operate in.
But government regulators do have to approve the final deal. Among them, the combined company's biggest customer, the Department of Defense. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
There are, as of this airing, no new tariffs on Mexican imports to this economy, despite a week or two of presidential threats of same. But the White House has now firmly linked immigration and trade policy, so Marketplace's Andy Euler looked into what happens next.
Migrants are leaving Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador to escape violent gangs and cartels that control most of the Northern Triangle economy. As part of the U.S.-Mexico agreement to avoid tariffs, Mexico is supposed to do a couple of things to control Central American migration. Gordon Hansen teaches economics at the University of California, San Diego.
That Mexico plays a role in detaining these individuals as they await the adjudication of their asylum requests. The harder part is Mexico playing a role in actually stopping the flow of migrants into the country.
Migrants crossing the southern border with Guatemala into Mexico. He says enforcement measures only treat the symptoms.
What we need is a much more systematic approach to deal with this intrinsic problem of domestic insecurity associated with the presence of major criminal organizations.
And no amount of military or police enforcement in Mexico can effectively counter the deep economic and social problems that are driving people to leave. Chris Wilson at the Woodrow Wilson Center's Mexico Institute says Mexico's resources are already strapped dealing with overcrowded detention centers.
This is hugely difficult for them to manage. There are essentially migrants in the streets in these communities.
President Trump says he won't hesitate to renew his tariff plan if he thinks Mexico doesn't succeed in curbing Central American migration. But economist Ray Perryman in Waco, Texas, says economic damage is being done right now.
We've been told tariffs are still on the table. They may come back again. And that sends a very bad message to the investment community, to people looking to hire or expand. It says things are really uncertain down here. You may not want to do anything.
Mexico's foreign minister said today that the agreement to avoid tariffs gives his country more time to show it can reduce the flow of Central American migrants. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Wall Street on this Monday, a fine start to the week. Thank you very much. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's a not unreasonable question to be asked about all the coverage that we and others have been doing about the Chinese technology conglomerate Huawei. And that question goes like this. What's it to me? I mean, I'm pretty diligent cybersecurity-wise. How much of a threat can one company be? Well, Huawei is more than just a telecommunications company. It's in phones and networks and the internet and the cloud. And with reach like that, Huawei is pretty hard to avoid. Now a new cybersecurity report calls that company a global cyber risk. Marketplace's Scott Tong has been visiting Huawei headquarters in southern China the past couple days. Here is his first report on Huawei and you.
It's clear there are two opposite narratives on Huawei. Back in the States, it's cyber risk of Chinese intelligence infiltrating this Chinese company, even if you don't realize it. You pull out your phone. Maybe it's a Samsung or an Apple. Catch up on your podcast. I like American history tellers. And no Huawei here, right? The Chinese company doesn't make your smartphone. It's not in your network. You're unaffected. But wait. That email you just fired off to a business contact in Asia? Think about how it got there. Your email is data that travel in tiny bundles or packets, says Priscilla Moriucci, formerly of the National Security Agency. Now she's with the cybersecurity firm Recorded Future.
The path that your packets might take from, you know, say, my phone in Boston, Massachusetts, to a colleague's laptop in, say, South Korea, we are very likely transiting Huawei-owned or manufactured infrastructure.
In her report, Moriuchi finds Huawei everywhere in the world's digital plumbing. It makes
everything from the very personal device level to the network level. Huawei also produces routers and switches, things to run both cellular networks, but also, you know, regular internet access.
And it's in cloud computing and digital surveillance. Outside the U.S., it dominates wireless telecom gear, and it sells more phones than Apple. The closest American company is, well, she can't think of one.
It's more than some of these companies that we sort of traditionally associate with the Western tech industry, like Facebook or Microsoft or Apple. This is far more scope and more data than even those companies, you know, could really have access to.
Data like your medical info, your bank account passwords, your company's secrets, info that Huawei could transfer or store or hack. Which brings us to the China narrative. Huawei, based in the Chinese tech capital of Shenzhen, hosted some American reporters last week, giving a tour of its distinctly European-themed campus. And it gave a technical talk on cyber issues. Company spokesman Joe Kelly says the U.S. has never found a Huawei smoking gun, at least in public.
In 32 years of business, there's never been any evidence that we've done anything wrong. If you've got it, I'd love to hear it. But I haven't met a journalist, and I know many who've got any evidence.
On campus, several Huawei workers spoke with pride about bringing affordable smartphone service to 170 countries and how the company was inspired by the likes of Bell Labs and IBM. Yet, says Executive Director David Wang, Huawei finds itself a political target.
We saw how a U.S. president could lie repeatedly and how the U.S. government could attack a private company that long worshipped American private industry.
For those who worry about Huawei, they say the company is so ubiquitous that it may be too tempting for Beijing to tap Huawei wires, listen in, or even hack U.S. infrastructure. Computer science professor Nicholas Weaver teaches at UC Berkeley.
You have to assume that the Chinese government will be no nicer than the U.S. government has been in terms of espionage.
That's the risk today, according to Priscilla Moriucci, the former NSA analyst. As for tomorrow, she worries about a new vulnerability. The next generation of wireless, 5G, will connect not just us, but our machines.
We will have everything from refrigerators to baby monitors to autonomous vehicles, and all these devices communicating without the security protocols could be catastrophic.
Whether Huawei is a risk there, it's clear this giant company is still growing. It has signed more than 40 contracts to bring 5G around the world. In Shenzhen, southern China, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
We've got some facts and figures, Huawei in context, if you will, at marketplace.org. The sports roundup today goes like this. There's the Women's World Cup now through the beginning of July. There's a possibly decisive Game 5 in the NBA Finals tonight, the Stanley Cup Game 7 on Wednesday. And then there's baseball. Yankees-Mets at Yankee Stadium tonight. Rangers at Fenway against the Red Sox. Dodgers-Angels at Angel Stadium. And those are just a couple. Point being, baseball is kind of always there, but in the background sometimes. Next time you're watching a game, though, it's worth taking a second to notice the places those games are being played. Paul Goldberger was the longtime architecture critic for the New Yorker magazine. He's got a new book out about some of those baseball stadiums. It is called Ballpark. Paul, thanks for coming into the studio.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
We should say, first of all, this is not, as you point out in the book, it's not an encyclopedia of all the ballparks in America and the world.
Definitely not. No. No. It's not a guidebook. It's something different altogether.
Well, okay. I was going to tell you what I think it is, but you
please,
tell me
no,
what
no,
you
no,
no
I,
you
I,
tell
I,
me what you think this book
okay.
is. Go ahead.
Well, it's a book about baseball parks as American public space, really, and how the history of ballparks and the history of American cities are kind of deeply intertwined.
And the root of that intertwinedness, if I can coin a phrase, is the part of the word in the title of this book, park. It's a little park. It's
yes.
a little garden space. It's a little greenery in the middle of what are often really dense urban environments.
Absolutely. It's why baseball parks are very different from any other kind of athletic facility, really. Baseball is technically played in both infinite time and infinite space. You know, only the diamond is exactly prescribed. The outfield is, mm-hmm. It is what it is. And in fact, the eccentricity and idiosyncrasy of ballparks was part of the nature of baseball as it grew up.
Take us to the point where cities and ballparks sort of came to be one, came to be conjoined.
Well, it really goes back to the beginning of baseball, which, despite the myth of Cooperstown and Field of Dreams, is as much an urban sport as a rural one. People started playing baseball on the edges of cities in open space. And then more and more people were interested, and they started charging people to come in and watch people play baseball. And thus, the baseball park was born.
Not to jump too far ahead in history, but there's Fenway, there's Tiger Stadium, there's also Wrigley Field.
Yes, there is. It's on the cover of the book.
It is on the. I know it's on the cover of the book. But I want to pull up a quote by Mr. Wrigley himself, who said, baseball is too much of a sport to be a business and too much of a business to be a sport. Somehow these men, mm-hmm. and they were all men, found a way to make it work.
Yes. Absolutely.
And to the tune of today, billions and billions of dollars.
Right. Well, Wrigley, though, had a really interesting take on it, which is that he did not invest very much in his team itself, which was maybe not so smart. It took a long time before the Cubs were doing very well. His whole idea was that if you give the people a pleasant place to go out on an afternoon, they'll come, and they care more about that than about whether the team wins or loses. I don't think that was really true. But the give the people a pleasant place to come part certainly was true and right. And I think it's one of the reasons Wrigley Field is so beloved.
This is a little bit sideways, but Wrigley Field,
mm-hmm.
Yankee Stadium,
right.
Dodger Stadium here in town, even though it's certainly the younger by decades of the fields I've mentioned so far, they have become points of civic pride.
Absolutely. Totally.
To this day.
Yes. Which is why, happily, they still have their names, and they don't have names that are for sale to the latest corporate bidder. You know, whatever one can say about the Yankees, at least they didn't sell the name of the place.
I should tell you, disclosure here, I grew up a Yankees fan, so.
It's okay. It's still a good thing. Still a good thing.
Although, not for nothing, the new Yankee Stadium, if I could just take a completely personal detour here, the new-ish, right?
Right, right.
For my money, it has no soul. It has no soul.
I don't love it either, although I think, in the end, it's a pleasanter place to go to a game than Yankee Stadium had been because the old Yankee Stadium was really gone. It was destroyed in a terrible renovation in the 70s.
I remember that when I was a kid.
If it had been kept, I would have had a very different opinion about whether new Yankee Stadium should have been built at all. But since it was really gone anyway and turned into one of the worst concrete relics of the 70s, I figured we might as well start over. So they did.
All right, so I'm mixing my decades here, but
that's
talk to me then about Camden Yards. Because Camden Yards, so we went from the Wrigley's and the Fenway's,
right,
and it was
right,
all great.
Right.
And then we went to the 50s and 60s where you had the enclosed stadiums and the concrete and all this, right?
Right.
And then in 1992, along comes Camden Yards, which was a revelation.
Total revelation. Baseball is the only thing that's changed 180 degrees because of one place, and that was Camden Yards in Baltimore, where the management of the Orioles – in the late 80s said they wanted something that had the feeling of an old-time ballpark. The formula has been replicated in a couple of cases, I think even improved on and built on. I think Pittsburgh is fantastic, actually, and even better, PNC Park. Yeah. San Francisco, I think, is really wonderful, what's now called Oracle. There have actually been quite a few that have actually, I think, taken the Camden Yards model and gotten even farther with it and done things even better and very unique to their cities.
So next time I'm in Dodger Stadium, yes, which is a mile from here,
right?
Which I love, by the way. I mean, there's nothing like, you know, a 7:10 start at Dodger Stadium.
Dodger Stadium is one of the greatest places there is to go to a ball game. It's maybe the worst place to get into and go out of.
Yeah.
But once you're in your seat, it is, I think, pure absolute pleasure.
So what should I, as Joe baseball fan and mildly interested in architecture, what should I be looking for?
Well, you look for that really wonderful kind of nice geometric 1960s vibe that it has, actually. Almost a little bit of a kind of Disney Tomorrowland vibe to it that's very nice. And in fact, they were influenced by Disneyland, which was only five years old when this was going up. A baseball park really should feel like it's in that place and that place alone. When you're in Pittsburgh, you see the bridges and the skyline. When you're here at Dodger Stadium, you see the mountains toward Pasadena. I love that. That's one of the things that makes being in a ballpark so special.
Ballpark is the book by Paul Goldberger. It's a lot of fun. It's a great book.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming in, Paul.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up.
I go to school, I do my homework, I go to work, and then I sleep for, 6 hours. So I'm tired all the time.
The actual cost of graduating from college debt-free. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 78 points today, 0.3%, 26,062. Neatly palindromic there. The NASDAQ up 81 points, 1%, 7823. The S&P 500, 13 points to the good, 0.4%, 28.86. Raytheon and United Technologies, we told you about. Raytheon up 0.6%. United Technologies slipped 3.3%. Elsewhere in that sector, the biggie Boeing was pretty much flat. The other big deal in deals today, Salesforce, the cloud-based software company, will acquire data firm Tableau Software for almost $16 billion. Salesforce stumbled 5.2%. Tableau surged 33% on the news. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.15%. You're listening to Marketplace. You know, Marketplace is a source you trust for information about the economy and how it affects our lives. We're also a nonprofit news organization, and we are counting on listeners like you to support this kind of journalism. Any donation helps, but if you give $30 right now, it'll be matched dollar for dollar by another one of our generous supporters, the Candida Fund. Please become a Marketplace investor today at marketplace.org, and thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Amazon has something new for the less than completely creditworthy consumers out there, something called Amazon Credit Builder, secured credit cards for Prime members who don't have sufficient credit to qualify for traditional cards. People put a deposit down as collateral and then get a card that potentially helps them build their credit. Nice idea, but does it work? Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
About 10% of Americans have low credit scores, and about 45 million don't have a credit history at all. That could make life really difficult, says Jose Quinones, the founder of Mission Asset Fund, a San Francisco nonprofit that helps low-income people with financial services.
And without that credit report, it's just impossible to do anything. In some states, you can't even get a job.
That's why his organization often works with clients to get a secured credit card. But they do have some problems.
Secure credit cards tend to be pricier than unsecured cards.
Larry Santucci is a research fellow at the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia, where he has studied the effectiveness of these products. He found secured cards more often require an annual fee, with the average being $25 a year. They also have higher annual percentage rates than the average credit card, upwards of 25%. But in his study, he found the cards did help about a third of account holders improve their credit scores enough to qualify for a regular credit card, what the industry calls graduation.
And what we've seen is that graduation rates have increased in recent years, while the time required to graduate has really decreased considerably.
But secured cards still make up less than 5% of new credit accounts, and those who need them the most face some hurdles even getting them, according to Dara Duguay with the nonprofit Credit Builders Alliance.
One of the biggest barriers to obtaining a secured credit card is the actual security deposit.
She'd like to see more services offer the option to pay the deposit in installments instead of one lump sum. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Good news and bad news for the college class of 2019. You are done for now if you choose with higher ed. That's the good news. The bad news is that if you borrowed money to pay for that degree, you're going to have to start thinking about paying it back real soon. The average student borrower graduates from a public university owing about $27,000, well over $30,000 from a private one. But there are ways to get through school without debt for lower income students in particular, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Portland State University's 26,000 students attend classes in a dense downtown neighborhood. A streetcar runs through the main quad. There's an urban mall where students hang out with Starbucks, a Ben & Jerry's. The kinds of places 22-year-old undergrad Emily Hodgson doesn't stop into very often. She doesn't have the time or the money.
I go to school, I do my homework, I go to work, and then I sleep for, 6 hours. So I'm tired all the time.
Hodgson didn't go right to college after high school. Her mother had developed serious health problems, which sapped the family's finances.
My dad made over $100,000 a year, but suddenly, because of all these hospital expenses, I had to take care of myself and find jobs on my own. And I told myself, I'm never going to go to college because I can't afford that.
But 3 years after graduating high school, she is enrolled, majoring in Japanese, performing in her chorus class's year-end concert. Hodgson is able to afford college through a new Portland State University program that offers 4 years tuition-free. It's for Oregon students who do well in high school and have less than $50,000 a year in family income. Hodgson's parents haven't supported her financially for years. She had to demonstrate her hardship to university officials.
I had my priest send a letter, a police officer who actually knew about my mom because she has had 911 calls. I had all these people who had official stamps and letters to get the 4 years free program.
It covers her tuition and fees. That's $9,100 a year. But there's still transportation, books, room and board. She lives with her two older siblings in the suburbs.
My brother and sister aren't going to take care of me. Well, they take care of me, but not financially as much. So I pay about $700 a month for rent, and then I have to buy my own food, clothes, and so I need a part-time job to make that work.
During the school year, she worked nights and weekends at a sushi bar. Hodgson is eligible to borrow up to $14,000 a year in student loans, but she really doesn't want to. She sees what college debt has done to her brother and sister.
They're struggling to buy a house and pretty much live an independent life because they're still paying off these student loans.
Hodgson's classmate, Deborah Westlight, is also trying to support herself and not take student loans. She attended community college to earn course credits and save money before transferring to Portland State. She works part-time teaching acrobatics classes to young children.
I am responsible for buying my own food and clothes and things like that.
She lives with her mother and contributes to the mortgage and utilities. Like her friend Emily Hodgson, Westlight doesn't have to worry about tuition and fees, but for a different reason.
My college education is being paid for entirely by my grandfather.
Westlight's grandparents were middle-class academics who...
The moment I was born, opened a 529 savings account for me.
How does that land for you, that family intergenerational money is available to you?
I don't tell people. It's not necessarily a shameful thing, but even though my parents are not rich at all, it feels almost dirty that I don't have this big stressor in my life that most of my friends do.
Westlight and Hodgson are scrimping and saving to get through college debt-free. That would give them a financial head start over the two-thirds of graduates who do take out loans and will hit the job market with an average of $30,000 in debt to pay back. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The This final note on the way out today, I'm sure you've heard about President Trump's interview this morning on CNBC, where he said, while criticizing the Federal Reserve for its interest rate policies, he said the members of the Fed are, quote, not my people. Setting aside for just a nanosecond the statutory independence of the Federal Reserve, the fact is, Mr. Trump appointed the current chair and both vice chairs of the Board of Governors. All right, we got to go. The Dow up 78 today, 0.3%. The NASDAQ up 81. That is 1%. The S&P 500 up 13, 0.4%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Daniel Shin. Our special projects desk is Tommy Andres and Eliza Mills. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.